So yes, we're a welcoming nation. We have one of the biggest intakes of refugees on a per capita basis in the world. So we have an enormous amount to be proud of, but we need to do it in a way which is responsible, because if you don't have the adequate and appropriate security checks in place, and somebody does go on to cause a catastrophic event, that will immediately undermine the public's confidence here in Australia in bringing people in through the migration program. So it's a question of balance, and that's what we seek to get right.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Peter Dutton has recently taken over as Minister for a new Super Department of Home Affairs, which will have oversight of national security, including the agencies of the Australian Federal Police and ASIO, as well as embracing his old area of immigration and border security. The government says this aggregation will strengthen national security, but critics worry about having too much power in one ministry. Peter Dutton joins us as our guest today. Peter Dutton, what do you say to those people who are concerned that civil liberties are being downplayed by having this mega portfolio?
Well, there's no basis for that comment at all. The legislation that we have in place around, for example, the Federal Police or the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission doesn't change under the arrangement that we've proposed. There's no greater laws that or arrest powers that have been introduced, or a lessening of protections that have been provided for under this new arrangement with Home Affairs. So again, I think there's a bit of rhetoric out there from the usual haters and dissenters, but it's not based in fact.
But we have seen George Brandis, for example, the former Attorney General, who obviously had doubts about this aggregation. It's not just the usual suspects, as you might characterise them.
Well, there have been people in favour of a Home Affairs portfolio and those against for a long period of time. For example, Kim Beazley was very much in favour of, my understanding is still remains very strongly in favour of, a Home Affairs portfolio. I believe the bill will be supported in the Parliament by Labor. It was a proposal put at one stage by Kevin Rudd. So there have been people in favour and against the construct of a Home Affairs portfolio for a long period of time. And people can speak about their own motivations or their own beliefs, but I believe that there's a very strong argument for the portfolio, and that's the reason that that we've put it together.
And just as a side point, of course, you have as your departmental secretary Kim Beazley's former advisor.
Well, Michael Pizzullo was Kim Beazley's former deputy chief of staff, and still remains friends with Kim, and no doubt having served Gareth Evans as well, I think. Mr. Pizzullo was an advisor within Gareth Evans' office and worked for Labor governments during that period of time. So I think he comes with a good perspective in terms of the balance that's required in his position as Secretary of this department.
Do you think in coming years we're going to see privacy more compromised for the sake of information sharing to fight crime? Is this an inevitable development over time?
I think there will always be the need, and I would always advocate for the need for adequate protections to protect the privacy of individuals, but also to protect the rights of individuals, including the victims of crime. So I have a particular interest in making sure that we do more in the space of child exploitation. So young children who are being exploited both here in countries within our region as well. And you always need to get the balance right to recognise the fact that people are using the internet and carrier services in a way that they weren't even 5 or 10 years ago. So if they're distributing information via the internet and using their computers, their smartphones, their electronic devices otherwise to spread that information, it will give rise to a discussion around whether or not that information needs to be exploited. But that's no different to debates that have taken place at the time of the introduction of mobile phones or pages. This is largely, I think, a discussion around technology, the appropriate protections in place, but the recognition of the fact that people are using, as we well know, in our own lives, computers and smart devices in a way that no generation before us has.
But you do see the need to share more information across agencies in this battle against crime?
If it's within the law, yes.
Now, the thrust of your public comments and the tone of your language are mostly emphasising security threats, the need for tighter border control and so on. This is quite a big language change from what used to be a more welcoming face in the old immigration department.
Certainly, when Australia was faced with a populate or perish model many decades ago, when we were faced with a flood of boat people out of Vietnam, go back to the end of the Second World War in the late 40s, early 50s, there was a different approach because the threat to our country was very different then than it is now. So as you've seen, people drowning on the Mediterranean, those people drowned at the hands of people smugglers that weren't in existence to the scale in decades past as they are today. We see in Indonesia, where we've got tens of thousands of people either prepared or making preparations to come to a country like ours. We've seen a million people flow into Germany. You've seen the rise of Islamic extremism in the form of IS and other organisations that would seek to do us harm. You've seen the advent of devices being carried onto planes. Now we're worried about people coming with false identities across borders. So the threat for us, given that the world is a much smaller place and that people are much more mobile, I just think we reflect that reality. And if the argument is that people can come and go freely across borders without appropriate checks, well, that is a recipe for domestic and international disaster.
So you're saying in earlier periods, nation building was more important, development of the nation by getting more people, increasing the population. Now the emphasis has got to be on security, basically.
It needs to have an underpinning of security because of the current threat that we face. People weren't flying planes into buildings in the United States. People weren't driving cars through crowded places in Melbourne or Paris or elsewhere, even 20 years ago, not to that extent. The threat of terrorism was largely limited, depending on the period of history, to the Middle East or to other parts of the world, including Europe. This is a problem for us now. So yes, we're a welcoming nation. We have one of the biggest intakes of refugees on a per capita basis in the world. So we have an enormous amount to be proud of, but we need to do it in a way which is responsible, because if you don't have the adequate and appropriate security checks in place and somebody does go on to cause a catastrophic event, that will immediately undermine the public's confidence here in Australia in bringing people in through the migration program. So it's a question of balance. And that's what we seek to get right.
Now, you're flagging the need to toughen the provisions about stripping Australian citizenship from dual citizens who've been foreign fighters. The government earlier brought in this legislation to do this, and yet you're saying it hasn't been effective enough. What is the problem with it, and what are you going to do? And this is only dual citizens, isn't it? You're not going to leave people stateless.
Correct. So the starting point for us, of course, is that we aren't going to render people stateless, and we've been very clear about that. But equally, we can look at places like the United Kingdom that I think have been more successful at taking British citizenship away from dual nationals who have been involved in terrorist activity and pose a direct threat to the United Kingdom. Since the law has been introduced in our country, there's only been one case, as I'm advised, where somebody has lost their Australian citizenship, a dual national. And the question is whether or not the legislation achieves the right balance. The point that I made in my press club speech the other day was that it is easier to revoke a dual citizen's Australian citizenship because of a fraudulent declaration around their application, and than it is to take citizenship away from somebody that we know has been involved in the conflict in Syria or Iraq fighting in the name of ISIS. This is the anomaly that we seek to address, and we're exploring ways with our resources within government, within the Attorney General's Department, as well as my own, as to how we might look at different options around that law.
So what do the Brits do?
Well, they have a couple of different components, and they've got a different constitutional framework than we face here in Australia. So there's the ability to exclude people on a temporary basis, and there is the ability for citizenship loss in a more liberal way, if I can put it that way, than what our law provides for in Australia. So again, it's a question of getting the balance right of providing protections, but I have a very serious and definite responsibility to look at foreign fighters who are returning to our country and whether or not we believe that we've got the balance right. Somebody returning to our country with the skills of imparted on them by the ISIS leadership to undertake a mass terrorist attack in our country, I think people rightly would argue whether or not it was we did everything within our power to stop that person from committing that act. And a fundamental question would be, should that person have been allowed back into our country?
So you're talking about people who are prospectively coming back rather than those who are back already?
Well, maybe some that that have returned and there's evidence sufficient to substantiate some action. But again, that's...
We're not talking about many people, though, are we?
No, we're not talking about...
150 or something?
Well, and it takes one to cause a mass incident that could result in the loss of 50, 100, 200 Australian lives. So when you start to talk about more than one, you start to talk about 10 or 20 or 100 or 200, as you say, that is a significant threat.
Because how many are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about a couple of hundred people that have left our shores. Some of them, fortunately, have been killed in action in the Middle East and won't be returning. Yet others will be returning or seek to return armed with skills that they didn't leave our shores with. And if they're returning with that ability, we need to seriously ask ourselves the question, are they worthy of returning to our country?
And what about the position of children?
Well, the position of children is vexed because there's a famous case with an Australian citizen that had his young, impressionable boys holding up severed heads of people that that were involved in the conflict. It obviously had suffered a brutal death at the hands of these terrorists. Now, again, we need to look at a case-by-case basis, depending on the age of the child, depending on the situation. But the important point to remember here, and certainly one that I would seek to emphasise, is that those children have been exposed to that barbarism, not through actions of the Australian government or the Australian people, but through the actions of the children's own parents. Now, there are some cases where children have been born to a terrorist Australian citizen that's living in the Middle East. There's a question as to whether or not that person should be afforded citizenship or whether that child should be allowed into our country. So again, these are all issues that we're contemplating at the moment, but they are complicated matters, and the facts are peculiar to each case, and we need to look at what is in our national interest, what's in our national security interest, and also, of course, what's in the best interest of those individuals, particularly where children might be involved.
Let's turn to immigration. Tony Abbott reopened the debate last week, calling for a big cut in the migrant intake. You've sent out some mixed signals. You seemed before that to suggest that the question could be a matter for debate. Last week, you strongly supported the government's current program. Do you think that Abbott's call, however, will resonate with many people? And can you just clarify what your own position is on this?
Well, Michelle, I just take issue with the premise of the question. The comments that I've made on two occasions, or three now, as I recall, where I've been asked publicly or made a public comment on the issue, when I've been asked, as my comments have been completely consistent with the previous statements that I've made, and that is, and there seemed to be some deal made of this at the time, where I said that we would make decisions about the numbers and the scope of the immigration program in accord with our national interest. Well, that's been the underpinning of the decisions that we've made about where the numbers should be set for a long period of time. So I didn't see anything remarkable in that comment. And equally, I've spoken about the benefit of migration into our country. I've made some tough decisions in terms of visa cancellations. We made some changes where we abolished the 457 program so that we could put Australian workers first. We celebrated the fact that we brought in 12,000 Syrians and Iraqis in addition to the 18,750 refugees that that we'll bring in over the next year or so. So I don't think there's anything inconsistent in what I've said, and I stand by those comments.
And you think the numbers at the moment of the overall migration program are right?
Well, the point I made the other day is that the numbers have to serve our national interest. So when there's a mining boom and companies can't find Australians to fill those positions, the whole idea of the skilled migration program is to bring foreign workers in to perform that work so that the company can keep its doors open and employ other Australian citizens, add to the wealth to the GDP of our country so that we can provide support to schools, to policing, to education, hospitals, etc. So when the mining boom is over and that sector is contracting, the number of migrants coming in to perform those jobs that no longer exist, of course, will reduce significantly as well. And that's the way in which the program must operate. We've got a significant number of international students that we bring in that are counted within the net overseas migration figure each year. Those students contribute to in excess of $20 billion a year to our national economy. They're significant factors in economic growth in our country. So we also made a very definite intervention into the debate last year where we're talking about the need for people to integrate in some cases more effectively than what they have in the past, because we want people to abide by Australian laws, to abide by Australian values. I don't want young girls being sold off into arranged marriages. I don't want girls suffering at the hands of some butcher performing female genital mutilation. I want young women to be able to enjoy an education the same as their brothers can. So there are all sorts of aspects to this debate, and my comments in relation to that I think have all been thoroughly consistent.
But just for clarification, in terms of the permanent immigration program, you think that the present level is about right, or is it time for a recalibration in view of other economic factors?
The number over the course of the last 12 months, again, because of economic factors, will be down by several thousand, but not by a large number, but nonetheless still down. And as I say, the number each year is dictated by what we believe is in our national interest. We've got a low birth rate, we've got an ageing population. There is a benefit in bringing high-skilled young people to our country so that they pay taxes, they start a life and contribute to the economy and socially. That's been the way that we've built our country up over successive decades, and I think we've got the balance right.
The government often points, and you often point to the high proportion of refugees who are on welfare, but doesn't this represent a failure by government and maybe non-government organisations too to give these people adequate assistance to get into employment, to give them adequate help to integrate into a society that's often very different from where they've come from?
Well, again, I think it's hard to make a generalisation. I think in some cases you can blame government instrumentalities for a lack of support. In some cases I think you can blame government instrumentalities for too much support. We've got a very generous welfare system that we didn't have when people were coming to Australia in the late 40s, early 50s, where people worked hard. They've amassed a lot of money in some cases, educated their children, their grandchildren, and they came as refugees and have made an enormous contribution to our country. So I think in some cases there's a view that the Australian welfare system is very generous and there's no need to work. So, but again, I don't think you can say any of those particular elements apply to across the board. I mean, this is, again, a case-by-case basis. But the fact is that you have some people that are suffering from trauma and torture. We provide counselling for that. The UNHCR says that Australia, along with Canada, are the two best performers in terms of providing support to newly settled migrants under the Refugee and Humanitarian Program. I think there's more that we can do around English language so that people can more effectively educate themselves, participate in the workplace, work up from a job that they've had at a low entry point into the workforce and work their way up into a higher paying position. So, you know, I think there are certainly aspects to it that we can improve, but I think individuals can share some blame. I'm sure government can share some blame, and we need to recognise that some people have come from very difficult circumstances. We need to provide support to those people.
Just turning to the offshore refugees, another group recently departed for the US, but progress has been very slow. How many have now gone, and do you think that the United States will take the full 1,250, which was the maximum amount, the maximum number mentioned in the original deal, and would you expect the US deal to be completed by the time of our next election?
Just to put into perspective, with a little bit of historical context here, the position we find ourselves in. As Immigration Minister, I haven't put anybody on Manus or Nauru. I inherited a very difficult situation, as Scott Morrison did when he came into the portfolio, where we've now been able to close 17 detention centres. We've now got 8,000 children out of detention, the 8,000 that Labor put there. Labor put people onto Manus and Nauru. And in terms of their progress, they didn't get one person off. So we've been able to broker an arrangement to, with then President Obama in office, now adhered to by President Trump, and we're very grateful for the engagement of the new administration. We're working toward the 1,200, something in the vicinity of 200 people have already left. There are a lot of critics within the media included that said that nobody would ever be lifted from Manus or Nauru to go to the United States. Well, we're 1/6 of the way through that commitment.
And we'll be completely through in a year's time?
Well, we're in the hands of the United States because they are conducting security checks. There will be some people that they will reject on security or other grounds and that they won't take into their country. And that's entirely appropriate, as is the case for Australia or New Zealand or anywhere else. Countries have a sovereign right to decide who comes into their country, and we'll work with the United States in each of the cases. But that's, you know, I think it's a significant achievement of the Turnbull government, A, that we're able to broker that deal, B, that we're able to get people off Manus and Nauru, and C, that we don't have new arrivals filling those vacancies as they arise.
And what number would be left over after if the deal was fulfilled? Not asylum seekers, refugees, and what happens to them?
There will be very few, but again, there are some people who are refusing to take the offer to go to the United States, which I think is...
Why is that?
Well, you can ask them, but I think it's... I think if you're a refugee seeking... If you're a genuine refugee seeking safe haven, you'd be pretty happy to go to the United States if a position was offered. So that's a question for those people to answer. Again, there will be some that the United States say that they won't take on security grounds or character grounds. And under the arrangement brokered by Mr Rudd and Labor and the Greens at the time, people that have been found to be refugees can settle. And in fact, some already have, over 30 now, have settled in PNG itself. And some of those people have gone on to get very successful jobs and have integrated into society there. There are some people on Nauru who won't leave because they've now entered into relationships with Nauruan nationals. Some people there have started up businesses, highly successful, and I'm advised that, that their intent is that they won't leave Nauru either. So there will be a residual amount.
Of what, several hundred?
Well, I think let's wait and see what happens, and obviously we're still working with other countries to see whether we might broker arrangements to see whether we can place people elsewhere apart from the United States.
Now, on Manus, since the detention centre has been closed, there have been reports of attacks by some locals on the people that have moved to the alternative accommodation. Also claims the facilities are incomplete and not adequate. Who's responsible for the health and safety of these people
well,
now?
Well, the PNG government, under the arrangement brokered by Mr Rudd, has responsibility for arrangements in the Manus precinct. So, but again, a couple of important points to make here. One is that if somebody acts outside of the law and assaults another person, they face the consequences of the law of that country, in this case PNG. There are some cases, though, where I've seen reports of refugees or people that have been found not to be refugees involved in sexual relationships with women on Manus Island, women that may have been in relationships with PNG nationals, and you would expect, like you would in any capital city or country town in Australia, the potential for domestic disharmony in that arrangement. Now, if that's happened, or in some cases I've seen reports of some of the Iranians referring to the PNG nationals as monkeys and the like, then that will, I suspect, provoke a response. That's not to say it's justified or that people should act outside of the law. And if they've acted outside of the law, then I would expect the PNG National Police to investigate those matters. So, but again, there's a lot of propaganda in this space, Michelle, and our task is to clean up Labor's mess, to get people off as quickly as possible, but to do it in a way that doesn't recommence the boats, because I'm proud of the fact that I've got 8,000 children out of detention and closed 17 detention centres. I want to close Manus. I've been very clear about that and clear up all of the arrangements as best we can. But it is precarious because there are people smugglers trying to put people onto boats now, and this problem is not going to go away. We're a highly valued destination because we have a generous education, health, welfare system, and people will always seek to come to a country like ours, and where you've got people smugglers willing to take money from innocent men, women and children, they will always provide boats, and I don't want to see those drownings at sea commence again. We've not had a drowning at sea, whereas Labor had 1,200. So there's significant equities in making sure that we get this right. And at the moment, my judgment is we've got that balance right.
Just a couple of things before we finish up. One is a very mysterious matter. The head of your Border Force section has been on leave at full pay for more than half a year now while an indiscretion is being investigated. And both you and your department have been extremely secretive about this. The matter's again has been up in Senate estimates indeed today. Why has what should be surely a fairly straightforward investigation taken so long, and how can this be justified to the Australian taxpayer who is paying out hundreds of thousands of dollars to someone not actually doing anything?
Michelle, again, the description of mysterious or whatever else, it's not something that I would use. There's a matter that's being investigated at the moment by ACLI, which is an independent authority, as you know. There's an investigation.
Just spell out that authority.
So it's a Law Enforcement Integrity Agency, and they have the power, the independent power, to investigate matters referred to them. I don't have any interference in that process, which is entirely appropriate, of course. And
has this now been taken over by the Prime Minister's Department?
And there is a joint investigation that's underway, including by the Australian Government Public Service, if you like. So there's nothing mysterious here. There's an allegation that's been made. It's been properly investigated. If you were to spin it around and say, well, we'd reinstated the individual or terminated the individual's employment prematurely, or that natural justice hadn't been afforded, then you would be equally critical. I haven't sought to interfere in the investigation at all. I've allowed it to run its course, and as I say, it's a statutorily independent authority that can undertake its work, and they can answer for their own timelines.
But I think what most people don't understand is how a fairly simple matter could take so long to investigate.
But what's the basis of you suggesting it's a fairly simple matter? I mean, what do you know about it that led you to that conclusion?
I think the allegation was that he gave preferment to someone.
There's an allegation that's been made, and it needs to be properly investigated. If there are other matters that are investigated as part of that, or give rise to another investigation, or there are documents that need to be explored, or forensic discovery of emails, and people need to be asked about that. I mean, all of that is part of an investigation, as you would expect, and it doesn't happen overnight. I know it happens overnight in television series, but in real life, it doesn't. And as I say, if reinstatement or termination had have been arrived at prematurely, then rightly you would have an argument to make that, you know, it hadn't been investigated adequately, or that you'd rush this, or that would be the, you know, the alternative argument. And I'm certain of the fact that this has been dealt with in the most expeditious way possible. All of us want these matters
to be... You must be a bit frustrated.
Well, all of us want these matters to be resolved as quickly as possible, but I'm not going to interfere in an ACLI investigation, and I'm not going to go against legal advice that's provided to me by the Australian Government solicitor during the course of an investigation. These matters should probably be investigated. Mr Quadvlig is the Commissioner of the Australian Border Force, so it is a very high office that's being occupied, and the matter should be properly and fully investigated. And it should be proper, it should be seen to be proper, and that's what has happened in this circumstance.
Now, just finally, on something very, very different, you've suggested the desirability of school children taking some form of loyalty pledge. What would that achieve, and do you feel in general we're not patriotic enough as a nation?
Well, the point I made in my speech the other day to the press club was not so much about the pledge as about us providing more information through civics course, if you like, or process within schools. Now, it's already a crowded curriculum, I understand that, but there are a lot of kids, particularly from migrant families coming to Australia, that wouldn't have a full appreciation of the history of Australia. And we celebrate and recognise our Indigenous culture, which I think is incredibly important, but equally, the institutions that keep us free and safe today, I think sometimes by children born here or children who are new arrivals, sometimes don't fully appreciate. And I think it would be important for us to re-emphasise what has made us a strong democracy, where our rule of law was formed, how our early settlers provided the infrastructure and the foundation stones for our court systems, for our you know, the privilege of the Fourth Estate to be able to ask questions freely, for our parliaments, our freedom of speech, the right for women to vote, etc. I think sometimes, and look, it's not a criticism. I think sometimes when you look at surveys, not just here, but in the United Kingdom, the United States, elsewhere, where people are asked questions about modern history or about some of the fundamentals of our history, they don't always have the answers. In fact, in many cases, I saw a study in the United Kingdom recently where people were talking about Margaret Thatcher, I think, you know, being a Prime Minister during the First World War. Now, if you're 12 years of age, well, maybe all of us look that old and we could have been around in that period of time. But I just think it's important for us to celebrate what has made us a great country, because if we don't, I think it can be easily lost. And we're a continuing democracy that really relies upon a lot at the moment that we take for granted. And I think it would be good, and I can't see the harm in us reminding children of the last couple of hundred years of history and why it's important to celebrate the great migrants who came from a war-torn Europe at the end of the Second World War, or the you know, the Gold Rush settlers, the Chinese, who have been part of our country for a long period of time. All of these people that have made go on to make great contributions to our nation, I think we should be celebrating that more. Now, in the United States, where they were born of a civil war, then that patriotism probably does exist, as we recognise, in a different way. We don't like their gun culture, but it comes from that period of time, and it also allows multi-generations to experience visits to national monuments and museums and have a greater appreciation of the modern history that I don't think we see present in our country, because we were settled in a different way. And not to say that we shouldn't recognise the mistakes made by early settlers in terms of the Indigenous inhabitants of this land and the rest of it, but I think it needs to be a more complete picture than it currently is, and it's something I feel very strongly about.
Of course, many people who've been here all their lives and are very familiar with our democracy are these days, according to all the surveys, very disillusioned with the political system, and the politicians, I guess, have got to take a share of blame for that. Do you see that as a problem?
It is a problem, and it's not just a problem of the politicians making. I think the media now has...
I said a share of the
blame. Well, it's, we won't need to get the exact portions right, but... you know, I think you know, if I might say, I mean, Michelle, you are one of the most respected voices within the press gallery now. But there are a lot of people, not just in the press gallery, but within the media now, who are working in a very different model in social media, tweeting, posting very quickly information that isn't sourced or verified in a way. That you've really made your own and others of your ilk over a long period of time. And I think that resulting, you know, outcome of that is that there is a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of questions that should be asked that don't get asked. And it's a superficial read sometimes of the public debate. So yes, politicians, particularly over the course of the last 10 years, you could argue, have a lot to answer. But the public is more demanding than it was, you know, during the period I was growing up, where people were more accepting of their political class and didn't question their doctor, whereas now they can Google before they go into the doctor's surgery and the rest of it. So there are a number of reasons, and it's a complex situation. But what you say is right. But that should just make it more incumbent upon all of us to make sure that we celebrate the fact that we are a wonderful democracy, and we can be cynical about our politicians and about different aspects of recent history. In the end, what is most important is that we protect the foundation stones that have made us a great democracy, because we could go off the rails very easily. I think we've been lucky over a couple of periods in our recent history where, you know, we could have resulted in constitutional crises, or there could have been enormous ramifications from global economic shocks that others felt that we didn't. And so I just believe very strongly that, yes, people can be cynical, but in the end, we have a lot to be proud of in this country. And sometimes I think we should be a little less cynical and more proud of what we've achieved, both in a parliamentary sense, but in a societal sense in a great country.
Peter Dutton, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon.